morning. Good to be with you. Hunter and everybody did a great job setting this thing back up the way it was before. I couldn't even tell coming in this morning, even though I knew that was going on. We had a sign on my door and on several other doors that says off limits. So that was good. There are places they were not allowed to go. Last week, we addressed the question, what do you want? And after spending some time thinking about it, I think that we decided that it probably wasn't really the answer expected of us and maybe even drilled into us by the media, especially social media and the advertising industry, because what we really want was probably not more money and more stuff. It's kind of like when they talk about hierarchy of needs and so on, or talk about evangelism, whatever. If you're trying to reach people who have nothing to eat and nowhere to lay their heads or deathly ill, that's what they need. But most of us are not in that situation. We have food to eat. We have a roof over our heads. We have clothes on our backs. And so then you go up to a little higher level of need, and that's, I think, where we are, because we're spiritual beings who want to live in the flow of the Holy Spirit. We want truly abundant lives so that joy and peace and love are overflowing in us. And we've noticed that in order for the Spirit to flow freely, we need to put off anything that blocks the flow of the Holy Spirit in our lives. Things like an unforgiving spirit, an unwillingness to own up to our own sins, the clothing we must take off in order to put on Christ. And so this morning we're going to go back to the same text we used last week, 1 Timothy 6, 6 through 10, and we're going to talk about it kind of from another angle. We're going to talk about greed this morning. Resentment and a judgmental attitude are something you wear on the outside. You can't really hide it. Hard to be resentful or judgmental and not have it come out in your actions and your speech. People know it. They come to know it over time. The problem with greed is it gets a little tricky. It kind of grows underground. None of us in this room this morning could disagree, I think, that there's a climate of greed in our country. No amount of money or possessions is ever enough. We live in a world now where millions seem like an insignificant amount because all we hear about is billions and even trillions. That's replaced millions, and we're all painfully aware of the havoc that can be wreaked when greed goes unchecked in other people, because, certainly you and I, we don't struggle with greed, right? There are, as far as I'm aware, no billionaires in our whole church. I don't even know if we have any in the city of Louisville. Maybe you do. Everybody here knows about people who have so much more than we do. But the truth is, I'm tempted by greed, and so are you. And the danger this morning is that we listen to these words for the next few minutes and we think of other people instead of ourselves. And that's a real danger, but not because in the next few minutes we're going to come up with a behavioral modification program that will make us less greedy, or because that's where our religion has gone astray. Religion is not a coat that we put on to cover up what's wrong with us. Religion, which in Scripture is actually a lovely word, is more like a meal that we ingest that changes us, transforms us from the inside. God isn't just saying don't be greedy for the sake of not being greedy. He's saying that there's an abundant life, and greed impedes the flow of that life in you. You can't have that abundant life and have greed. We all struggle with it from time to time. We all have this overwhelming desire to acquire more stuff, more whatever. I was reading kind of an offhand joke this morning that said that that's kind of the unofficial mission statement of many churches. More. That's, I think it's true. It's sad, but it's true. What we think is going to make us happy when reality is going to end up both suffocating us and owning us. Not only trapping us, but keeping us from experiencing the abundant life. So let's go back to 1 Timothy 6, verses 6 through 10, and consider these words again. But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. Those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap, and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people, eager for money, have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. Greed is a trap that's keeping us from experiencing the abundant life. Now, all of us are going to have, at one time or another, self-serving desires, mismanaged appetites, an excessive urge to possess something in order to bring immediate gratification. We all will have those from time to time. And for greed to take root in your life and in my life, I have to convince myself that I need this, I deserve it, and if I don't take control, I will never get it. And all those things take me and put me right in the center of my own very, very small universe. Now, greed isn't necessarily linear. There's usually a downward cycle that we get on for greed to really take root in our hearts. One of the first things that's going to happen in my life, if I'm going to move toward greed, is I'm going to have to get involved in the comparison game. I have to compare myself. I have to compare my circumstances. I have to take a long look at you and decide that I like your clothes better than I like my clothes. You drive a nicer car. You live in a nicer house. I heard about your vacation to a place that's better than the place I can go on vacation. Your job is better. Your spouse is better. Your children are smarter and brighter and more athletic. More well-behaved even, maybe. I'm not sure. But I have to get the scales out. And I have to put myself on one side and you on the other, and I have to think of myself as ending up poorer because of it. And that'll begin to lead me in this thing called greed. And the object of my comparison doesn't really even have to be an individual. It can be an amalgamation of individuals, or just an impression I get from watching television or going on Facebook or whatever, exposing myself to other people, even going out to a restaurant, looking at the people around us in the parking lot. I mean, I can get that impression from all kinds of places. And that'll begin forcing me into this thing called greed. Other people have it a lot better than me. Comparison is the first step down. Something else I think that usually happens on the downward spiral is I have to feel that there is scarcity. Now, here's what I think is important about this word. What we're really talking about is perceived scarcity. There's only so much. And I have to believe there's not really enough to go around so that everyone can have enough. Things are scarce. Good things are scarce. And I have FOMO. I'm afraid of missing out all these things that are there because there's only so much perceived scarcity. I'm going to lose out. I believe God has a limited amount of material blessings, for one thing, that he can pour out. You just got more than I did, and I'm not feeling very good about that. In order to have greed take root in our lives, you have to throw in just a little bit of envy and a little bit of jealousy. I have to look at you and wish I had what you had, even to the extent that I hope you have less so that I can look like I have more. That's a really sick thing, isn't it? But that's the way the world works. I've stopped getting entertainment value out of watching all the athletes who are getting new contracts or want to get new contracts, and their contract has to be bigger than all the other athletes that also got contracts. It's just part of the game. It's expected. If he got $40 million a year and I'm about as good as him, I have to get 41. And the whole world knows it. That's how it works. I mentioned before a survey they did at Harvard. It's been several years ago. But these numbers would have to change now due to inflation. But here's what the students were asked when they did the survey. Would you prefer option number one, everybody in America would make $100,000 a year? Or, including yourself. Option number two, you would only make $75,000 a year, but everyone else would make $50,000. Which one do you choose? And the vast majority of students at Harvard chose option number two. They'd rather have less as far as they had more, as long as they had more than everyone else. So it isn't really about how much I have. It's about having more than other people. For greed to take root, a couple of other things have to happen. There has to be a sense of urgency. I need this, and I need it now. I'm not willing to wait for God's timing on it. I'm not willing to wait for the journey God has to take me on to get it. I need it now. And always greed has a deceitful element to it, where I have to deceive and lie in order to get what I want. And what sits in the middle of all of this is some kind of hunger, some kind of appetite for something you and I have that results in greed. So for the next few minutes, let's take a look at what the Bible has to say about greed. 2 Peter 2, verse 3, Peter warns about teachers in the church who, in their greed, will exploit you with fabricated stories. There were teachers going around to the churches, charging money for their teachings, and then make up stories to tell in order to get the money. Has anybody ever lied to you in order to try to get money from you? Huh. Every day? Every time you turn on the television or surf the internet, people lie to you in order to get money from you. Try to read your emails. Hopefully your spam filter kicks out most of them. And their greed will exploit you with fabricated stories. Do Christians do that? Again, just turn on your television. Listen to the radio. There are people in the church that are not just greedy, they're really good at it. They become what Peter would call experts in greed. And in doing so, they've actually wandered away from the faith. Next passage, James 5, 1 through 5. We could spend a whole sermon or two on that passage. We won't have time this morning, but we'll read it quickly and think about it. And I think what's interesting is it starts off by saying, you rich people. So James is written to Christian communities, and he's including Christians in this statement. Now listen, you rich people. Weep and wail because of the misery that's coming on you. Your wealth has rotted, and moths have eaten your clothes. Your gold and silver are corroded. Their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire. You have hoarded wealth in the last days. Look, the wages you failed to pay the workers who mowed your fields are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. You have lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You have fattened yourselves in the day of slaughter. Their lives are defined not by giving, but by consumption for themselves while withholding fair wages for those who serve them or work for them. Jeremiah 6, verse 13 is explaining why Jerusalem is about to be destroyed and her people carried into captivity. Jeremiah introduces this section by saying, "This is what the Lord Almighty says." And in verse 13, for the least to the greatest, all are greedy for gain. The prophet says, Whether you're the least or the greatest in society, it doesn't matter. All of them are struggling with greed. Greed for gain. And specifically includes the religious leaders. He said prophets and priests alike all practice deceit. And then in Matthew chapter 23, Jesus pronounces 7 woes on the Pharisees for their hypocrisy. The 5th woe is in verse 25. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they're full of greed and self-indulgence. Elders, preachers, worship leaders, teachers, other people in the church, leaders in the church, cleaning the outside of the cup, but inside full of greed and self-indulgence. He says, in the name of religion, you walk around looking great on the outside, but I know that on the inside, your lives are primarily about greed and self-indulgence. And I have to admit, I struggle with being judgmental about this stuff. I don't know. I mean, I see Christians walk out of churches or going to restaurants or whatever, and it's obvious they're Christians and all that, but they're flaunting their wealth. And so I don't need to be judgmental, but I tend to be. Finally, Luke 12, Jesus says, not only should we guard against greed, he says, be warned there are all kinds of greed. It's not as simple as just financial greed. It's not as simple as just money and stuff. Then he goes on to remind us that your life is not about the abundance of your possessions. Again, when Jesus warns against greed, he isn't calling us to have a narrow, miserable life. Just the opposite. He's saying that getting free from the grip that possessions have on our lives is the way to have an abundant, blessed life. So let's take it seriously for a moment. Jesus saying that there are all kinds of greed. Let's look at, I think, 4 different kinds of greed, when maybe you'll see yourself this morning as we go through them. The first is most obvious. The Bible talks frequently about financial greed, about the drive to have an abundance of possessions and money. And when it comes to financial greed, there's one passage in particular that I think really stands out to me. Luke 16, Jesus tells a story about a man who's had a really good year. The market has soared. His investments have taken off. He's really raking it in. His ship has come in. His stocks are up. He's acquired more and more, and the barns that he's created to collect his crops won't hold the abundance of what he has this year. So rather than taking his surplus to bless other lives, he says, I'm going to tear these barns down and build bigger barns to keep all my stuff. So listen, I think this is important. In financial greed, we make the mistake of becoming cul-de-sacs rather than conduits for the generosity of God in our lives. We become dead-end streets and barns with no doors that open to anybody but ourselves, and we keep collecting more and more and more and shoveling it in. And it's easy to look around and find 25 people who have more than you and pat yourself on the back and think, well, I don't do this. But even in our backyard, there are thousands of poor people who we could be looking at instead of looking at how to build a bigger barn and store more and more stuff. And there's a whole world out there that if we compared ourselves to this world out there, we would see how quickly we become cul-de-sacs and dead ends for financial greed. The second kind of greed that the Bible talks about in a number of different places is sexual greed. The mismanaged appetite for this amazing gift God has given to people who promise to share life together with no one else. This form of intimacy, deeper than any other kind of intimacy that's reserved for that relationship, to be misused and mismanaged, to be grabbed after in a gluttonous way to satisfy our desires. Inside marriage, outside marriage, it can be in the form of pornography, it can be in the form of an actual inappropriate physical sexual relationship with someone, anyone other than your spouse. It can be an emotional entanglement with someone else's spouse that has sexual undertones, but since nothing is physical has happened so far, you're congratulating yourself. And God says it's all greed. It's all striving to get something from another person that God says is not appropriate, is not yours. 2 Samuel 11, we read how David struggled with this, the man after God's own heart. The story tells us that one night David got up, maybe he couldn't sleep, got up from his bed and began to walk on the roof of the palace. And while he did, he noticed a woman, who was beautiful, bathing on the roof of a nearby home, and her name was Bathsheba. The story says David saw her and that she was beautiful and that he lusted after her, that he sent for her and brought her to him. He was a king. He had an inappropriate sexual relationship with her. She wound up getting pregnant. In his deceit to cover it up, he pulled her husband back from battle and brought him home in hopes that he would go in and sleep with his wife, and people would think, maybe even the husband himself would think, that this child was his own. But the soldier had more integrity than David did in this moment, and he would not go into his wife out of solidarity with his troops who were still in the field fighting. So in a last-ditch effort to try to cover up his behavior, David sent him back to the war carrying a message to the generals that when he was on the front line, they would pull all the troops back from him so he would be killed in battle. All of it in an attempt to cover up the outcome of uncontrolled sexual greed. I think the saddest part about this story is if you go back just a little ways, you realize God had been so good to David. God had given him not only everything he wanted, but way more than that. But it wasn't enough. He'd been an obscure shepherd boy, but God saw his heart that it was pure. So God made him king, gave him a family and a palace and armies that were victorious over his enemies. And still, in his greed, David reached out to take what wasn't his. And that's an old story, thousands of years old. And yet, it's a news story. You see it in the news every day. Still happens, just like that. There's the third kind of greed that's around, the word power. In Matthew chapter 2, we read about a man who had many uncontrolled appetites, King Herod. Most of all, he was greedy to gain and maintain power. He was a Roman client, king of Judea, given the title King of the Jews by the Roman Senate. When he got word that a child had been born who prophecy said would become king of the Jews, he was furious. His power was being threatened, so he began to do everything he could to find this baby and kill it. And when he couldn't do it, when he realized he'd been outwitted by the Magi, in his anger he said, just kill every male child 2 years and under. Now, again, it's easy to see a king or president or prime minister of some country and suspect they might have greed for power. But let's not dismiss ourselves from the struggle of greed in the context of power. Have we ever craved more attention, more respect, a higher position than other people, boasted about our accomplishments and wanted people to know how important we are? For many of you that are in positions of influence in business or education or politics or the military, this is a huge issue. How does a Christ follower use the power God has given you in ways that are appropriate and that honor other people instead of lording it over other people? Then the fourth kind of greed we want to consider, this one may surprise you initially when you hear about it, but after you think about it for a second, you probably won't be surprising, and that's what we can call it spiritual greed. There's a way in which even our relationship with God, we can get greedy. Just like the children of Israel who wanted one mountaintop experience after the other, when we've had an encounter with God in a profound way, it can turn into spiritual greed. We insist that every devotional time, prayer time, worship assembly, retreat, or church camp be better and better than the last one. Better, that is, in terms of the emotional impact it had on us. When our greed to connect to God on that mountaintop makes us not live faithfully in the ordinary days, or as St. John of the Cross talks about, and his poem, The Dark Night of the Soul. We feel as if we should never have to struggle in our faith. Then maybe that's best described as spiritual greed. So every one of us struggles with greed, and not only is greed harmful, it interrupts this flow that we're desperate for in our lives. What are the words, what are the thoughts from God that can get us away from that need to always want more? I think the first is the word, we talked about this word last week, we'll talk about it again, the word enough. I wonder how often we think deeply about the goodness of the word enough. Because here's the truth, there may be a very rare exception in this room, but I would say most of us, we have enough. Dallas Willard would often begin his morning by reciting the 23rd Psalm out loud to himself. I've mentioned this before. He said, sometimes I don't even make it through the whole 23rd Psalm. I only get to a certain passage that grabs my soul, and I live with that for the rest of the day. And Dallas said when he was a young boy growing up in Arkansas, one of his responsibilities was to care for sheep. He said there are only two times when sheep will lie down in a green pasture: when they know they are safe, when they've had enough to eat. The Lord is my shepherd, so I have everything I need. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. Why? Because my future is secure and safe in Jesus, and because he has, my Lord, I have enough. In Exodus 16, there's a story of the children of Israel who've been for hundreds of years enslaved in Egypt. God heard their cries for freedom, so he sent Moses, and they got out. And as soon as they got out, they started remembering all those great restaurants back in Egypt, and saying, we want to go back to where there were leeks and onions. Is that what you want to go back to? So God gave them water and quail, and then in the morning, when the dew came, a thin little white substance that formed over the dew that was bread that they called manna. When they went out and they saw this manna, they said, what's this? Which is the word manna. What's this? They'd never seen it before. In Exodus chapter 16, God says, here are your instructions. Go out and gather in the morning what you need for today, but don't gather enough for tomorrow. Gather just enough for today. And the truth about manna in Exodus, think, finds its way into our prayer, the Lord's Prayer. Give us this day our daily bread. If he does that, that's enough. The second word that helps us overcome greed in our lives is the word content. When's the last time you've asked yourself how content you are? Have you felt deeply content because of what God has done in your life? Content is a powerful word. In our sermon text this morning, Paul says that when you combine godliness with contentment, you are truly wealthy. And he reminds us that we were born with nothing, we will die with nothing. So why in the world would we waste years in trying to accumulate even more things? Don't fall into that trap. Be free and be content. Philippians 4, Paul says, I've learned to be content, whatever the circumstances. Have you learned that? I'm still working on that. I have learned, he said, to be content, whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need. I know what it is to have plenty. I've learned the secret of being content in every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. That's incredible. That ought to be what we're working for, what we're moving toward to grow into. Content in every situation. Then in Hebrews 13, verse 5, we read, keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have. Then I love the rest of that verse because God has said, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. I'm with you today and I will always be with you. I won't forsake you. So be content. If God's with us, we know we'll be taken care of. Verse 6 reminds us we'll have nothing to fear. So the first word is enough. The second word is content. The third word, and this word I believe has power, kind of like nuclear power, in getting us free of greed is the word grateful. Here's the secret to the power in the word grateful. When you're grateful, you have to have really kind of a person attached to it, don't you? You don't write thank you notes and put them in the mail with no address on them. When you say thank you about something, you're saying it to someone, and gratitude implies the existence, I think, of a good God to whom I am grateful. And unleashing the power of gratitude in our lives as Christ followers to a God who not only created us and created a world of breathtaking beauty, he also said when he saw that we were separated from him because of our own sin, he said, I'll give up what is most precious to me, my son whom I love, to get you back with me, to restore our relationship. And if that doesn't incur gratitude in you, I can't imagine what would. Hebrews 12:28, therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, it's a stable kingdom, secure, you can safely build your life on that kingdom. Since we're receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us be thankful. And so worship God acceptably with reverence and awe. We're misinformed. We think it's only here on Sunday mornings that we worship. This verse reminds us, I think, that every time a grateful word to God escapes our lips or forms in our minds, we are worshiping God. And that gratitude is freeing us up from the insatiable desire for more. Instead of thinking about what we don't have, we're grateful when we think about all that we do have. The friendships, the relationships, the family, the church, the material blessings we have, all these good things, work that we can do maybe, you know, our jobs. We just have so much, the country we live in, we have so much to be grateful for. And then the last word, I think, when we're truly free of greed, we become a staggeringly generous people. 2 Corinthians 9, verse 11, Paul writes, here's what will happen in your lives. You will be made rich in every way so that you can be generous on every occasion. You're not blessed or given things in order to be a cul-de-sac, but to be a conduit. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, again, Paul says Timothy should charge those who are rich in this world, people like most of us, to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. Why? So that we can live life in the flow. So me, he says, take hold of the life that is truly life. Change in our lives as individuals comes both incrementally and exponentially, both in small little ways in which we're faithful to get away from greed and give, and then in life-defining moments of huge amounts of staggering giving. It's true in our individual lives. It's true in our church. God is good to us all the time, right? He blesses us every day with sunshine and rain, days to work, nights to rest, but sometimes God staggers us with his extreme generosity and addresses our greatest needs in the most extravagant way imaginable. We'll never be like him as long as greed has a hold in our hearts. He created us to live abundant lives, lives of freedom and joy and peace, and he's given us enough already. Our cup is already overflowing.